there's a balance we got to find in that. You know, the law and order hang them high is not going to work, and then the coddle them and enable them until they're dead isn't going to work either. Like, you've got to get in that middle somewhere. And that's going to take people with lived experience getting out there and hitting the streets.
All right. Jessica and Ben. Jessica and Ben, where are you guys from originally?
Memphis, Tennessee.
South Memphis.
Memphis. And
I've lived in 14 states, but if I got to pick where I'm from, it's going to be Memphis.
And you guys have similar childhoods or?
No.
Polar opposite. So I was born on Fort Campbell to an Army Ranger and an industrial engineer. My parents are still married. I had storybook perfect childhood. There's no logical reason my life ended up where it did. Hers is polar opposite.
Were there addicts in your family, Ben?
So it didn't get talked about growing up, but yeah. More alcoholics than addicts. Both my mom's parents died alcoholic deaths, and then ended up having an uncle that drank himself to death. So yeah, I mean, the gene was there for sure.
Yeah. And Jess, tell me your story.
Well, it was actually really good until I was about 8 years old and my mom's little closet alcoholism went full-blown alcoholism, and she got extremely violent. So we were just beat shitless as kids. And I was the oldest, so I had to kind of protect my brother and sister. And then around age 13, 14, she decided that she wanted to try crack and loved it. And so that took on a whole different life. And we pretty much just didn't have anything because everything was going to her crack addiction. And this mom that was once in the choir and every day we'd go to church, now she's smoking crack. We're going to trap houses. She's teaching me how to steal. We're dining and dashing in restaurants. So very different from Ben's story.
It's crazy how drugs will change the motives, the ethics, just the whole nature of a human being.
Oh, yeah. Especially crack. Yeah, I always grew up thinking crackheads and heroin junkies were scum of the earth. And then it became one.
So tell me your story. How did you guys end up getting involved in all this?
What a convoluted story. So I, like I said, man, I had a perfect childhood. I was, gifted. I was a member of Mensa when I was 12, published in the journal Neurology for a clinical study I led when I was 14. What's funny is by the time that study got published, I was already locked up in rehab out here at a place called Capistrano by the Sea, which I think burned in the late 90s. So when we moved to California when I was 14, I'd already discovered alcohol and females could change the way I felt. So I had become very addicted to anything that changed the way I felt. And so I discovered meth when I moved out here, 14 years old, and my parents had absolutely no clue how to deal with that. Like I said, it didn't get talked about a lot, even though addiction maybe was in the family somewhere. I think they thought it's not going to affect us. It definitely affected us. I turned what was supposed to be a 10-day stay at Capo into a 90-day stay. Eventually, they shipped me off to one of those places in Utah that you hear about on the Netflix documentaries. I was smart enough to realize I wasn't going to run or manipulate my way out of that place. So I buckled down and did what I was supposed to do, completed the 18-month program in, I think, 9 months. We moved back to Alabama. I ended up graduating high school with honors, got a math scholarship to Auburn, started ROTC there. I wanted to follow my dad's footsteps. And then the towers came down on September 11th. Now, behind the scenes, I was already drinking my way out of college. I was back on coke. I was, dabbling in everything I could find. And so I saw 9/11 as an opportunity to avoid the consequences of my bad decision-making and dropped out of college and enlisted, made really bad decisions while enlisting and lied about literally everything. Like I told them, never been on ADHD meds, never dealt with anxiety, never done drugs. I've had, and this is the one that came back to bite me in the ass, never had any injuries. I did not have an ACL. So by the end of the summer of 2002, I'd broken my leg and they figured out I lied. So I got discharged with no benefits. It was honorable, but no benefits whatsoever. And I just continued to drink at that problem. That went on for years. I reconnected with an ex-girlfriend from middle school, moved up to Charlotte, kept drinking, but went back, finished college, started a family, got a job at Pfizer Pharmaceuticals as a sales rep. And that's what took us to Memphis in 2006. 2007, Easter Sunday, my parents tried to do an intervention, which this, you know this, they rarely go well. And mine definitely didn't. I wanted nothing to do with it. So I got.
So you were using throughout that whole period?
I was drinking throughout the whole period. Well, no, let's call a spade, I was using it too. I mean, doctors were my dope man at that point in time. So in my mind, like, I'm not getting high. But I am. I'm on Adderall, like super therapeutic dose of that. I'm on anxiety meds out the ass, so Xanax, Klonopin. They're all prescribed, so I'm rationalizing it away, but drinking very heavily on top of that. So I left the intervention at my parents' house in Georgia, flying back to Memphis, going about $130 outside of Scottsboro, Alabama, in single car accident, flipped my ex-wife's Honda. Went through the rear windshield and, I mean, just destroyed everything. Like, what was left of the leg I'd messed up in the Army ended up crushing the entire top half of my tibia. It's like bone filler now. Broke my pelvis in three places. And I was like, you know what? I should maybe not drink. I've got, at that point, two kids, a wife, a good job. Like, I should get my shit together. And so I did. I didn't want to accept that I had any sort of a problem, though. So I just white-knuckled it. You know, I wasn't doing AA, wasn't going to meetings, didn't have a sponsor because I didn't have a problem in my head. I'm just, you know, I drink too much. And so I stayed sober. I don't know how. For like 4 years almost. I ended up leaving Pfizer, going to the medical device industry to make more money, and the drinking culture there is, like, it was worse than it was at Pfizer, probably. And so I ended up leaving that, too. I really did want to stay sober. I just didn't want to accept that I had a problem. So I ended up starting my first business in 2009. I've been self-employed since then. It went really well. Like, I was making crazy money. And then a buddy of mine came back from Iraq minus a leg, and he had a pain pill addiction. And around the same time, my leg got infected. They had to put a bunch of hardware in there. So I had methicillin-resistant staph infection and ended up on pain pills too and decided, you know, I'm going to drink. Like, I'm good to drink. And so that started that slippery slope back. Backstory, I'll make the long story short. By 2013, that pain pill addiction had progressed to pain pills that were prescribed, but not to me, to heroin. By Halloween of 2013, I had an $800 a day habit and ran that business completely into the ground, destroyed my marriage, got arrested for the first time on, I think it was July 28th of 2014. I was on my way back home from my warehouse where I had a firing range that I would go to blow off steam. I got pulled over with, I think, a subgun, two suppressors, a lot of guns, and at the time, I thought a lot of dope. Now, given the work we do today, I had not much dope at all, but I had like 6 grams of heroin, 6 grams of crack on me, and they charged me like I was Pablo Escobar. Like, you know, you're selling dope, the guns are to protect the dope yourself. Like, this is like a day's worth of dope for me. But that's what started the catastrophic slide downwards for me. Well, legally speaking, obviously, I've already got a catastrophic slide downwards. They ended up putting me on drug court, court ordered me into a halfway house, which really pissed me off. I've got a house on a golf course, a wife, kids, business, cars, like, and you're going to make me go live in a halfway house. I ended up getting kicked out of that halfway house, I think in 8 days. Side note that we'll come back to later, I own that halfway house now and actually work with the same drug court that tried to send me to prison. Ex-wife filed for divorce. got a bullshit restraining order to keep me away from the house and the kids, and I relapsed. And the drug court judge was like, we're going to give you one last chance. You're going to Narcotics Anonymous meetings now, and you're going to answer to this guy, Brian Owens, who is going to basically be your daddy for the next 18 months. And so through Brian, I met her at Narcotics Anonymous.
Not a good place to start a relationship.
Yeah. 0 out of 10, do not recommend. Don't go meet people in NA. We're sitting here today, but that's a miracle. Like, we went through a whole lot of, well, you'll hear in a minute. All right, so tell how you ended up in the NA meeting.
Well, I just started using drugs since I was like 13, and obviously you heard how I was raised, so I just wanted to numb everything, so I just started doing drugs. And my life was nothing like his. I didn't have a scholarship. I didn't care about school. I just wanted all your drugs. So I, you know, started on weed, then it went to pills, then it went to meth, then it went to anything I could get my hands on, and I was like jumping from house to house just so I could stay away from my mom and stay away from the house that I was living in. So I would just go wherever I could. I would just follow the drugs. And got with a guy that I did not know I was doing heroin. He would like sprinkle stuff on my weed. He was like, it's VitaBlend. I was like, fuck, it's vitamins on my weed? Let's do this. So I started smoking it. And then before I know it, like, I started kind of getting sick when I didn't have it. And I was like, what the fuck? What are you putting on this weed? What actually is this? And he was like, okay, so it's heroin.
Surprise.
Surprise. I was actually working as a medical assistant. I was smoking on the side. I did not smoke before I went to work. I was very serious about my job. But like at night when I got off work, I would smoke weed and I didn't know that I was actually smoking heroin. And I ended up just quitting that job because all I wanted to do was find more heroin. So we started just doing random stuff, stealing. I would spend 12 hours a day like finding metal, scrap metal, because he wasn't a very business savvy kind of guy. And not like Ben is. And It was a big snowball effect, and I ended up getting pregnant with the guy that got me on heroin, had a baby, and then like 4 months later, my mom overdoses and dies, so that just threw me into more, I just wanted all the drugs. So
as one does.
I think that went on for about 4 years of me chasing heroin, and I had enough, and really, I hadn't had enough. My dad was like, look, you need to do something, because he had seen how this went for my mom. So I went into treatment for the first time and started going to NA, because they said, that's what you're supposed to do, and I met Ben in NA, and we were clean together for, I think, about a year.
Yeah, we did good. Like, they used to call us the NA power couple, and I alluded to females being one of my drugs earlier, and that came back, and like, we'd been together like 6 weeks and there was another female, just found out about that, and that fueled a relapse, because that's what I did at the time when I didn't like the way I felt. I would get fucked up to change it, and she beat the hell out of me. Some of these scars on my face are from her.
Well, I later found out that I was pregnant with our child.
Yeah.
Like, so right after I found out about this female.
She didn't leave. But I did get terminated from drug court. They gave me a $200,000 bond. They really wanted me to go to prison. The judge told her, you know, like, Pop Smoke, this guy's a piece of shit, which I was. You know, I'm not disputing that. Somehow we made it work. We had the kid, James. He's 9 now. I relapsed again while she was in the hospital with James. Ended up getting arrested when he was like 2 weeks old. More dope, no bond, sitting in jail for 30 days that time, I think. Mm-hmm. Unbeknownst to me, she had not stopped taking the pain pills they'd given her for the C-section. I came to find out later, she's just like I am. When she doesn't like the way she feels about something, she's going to take substances to blunt that. So she's on pain pills. I get out of jail. I get my shit together. We're getting businesses back off the ground. This is like 2016 going into 2017. I started up. I restarted the business I'd run into the ground, which was electronics recycling. And then we started a tactical business selling gun parts online and ammo. And that took off really well. getting into the summer of 2017, like I started to notice, hey, there's a lot of money going out of the bank account. What's going on, Jess? And she finally admitted, she'd been, and I'm talking like $7,000-$8,000 a month. You know, she's back on pills.
I was trying everything in my power not to go back on heroin.
Yeah.
So I was like, I'm just going to keep buying pills.
A lot of pills. I think, I'm trying to remember the order of events. I don't guess it really matters. It all happened.
Well, on our tactical business, we were doing very well. We were in a massive house in a gated community. Like, everything looked really good from the outside looking in. And the casino shooting happened.
Oh, yeah. The Vegas shooting.
And so out of nowhere, the underwriters just kind of pulled
for
the rug
a credit
out.
Card processing. We were the like number two distributor of the product that Jackass used in the Vegas shooting, and so our credit card processor shut us off, like seized basically all the money we had in processing with them, and we did what junkies do best, and we relapsed. I think that was so. We both went back to active addiction
quickly,
like full-blown, you know, heroin. And then at some point, like, we're still running these businesses, but we're, you know, we got a $1,000-$1,500 a day habit between the two of us. You can't maintain anything long when you have a habit that big, you know. It doesn't matter how much money you're bringing in. You're going to start neglecting the things that are bringing in the money. And, like, there's all sorts of other crap that happened. Like, she stabbed me. We ended up getting evicted from the house. And that was the beginning of 2019. And when we got evicted, like, we gave up, dude. We gave up. That kid that we'd had together was two.
Crack had already come into the picture by then. Like, I never wanted to touch crack. And then one day I was so dope sick. Ben had some crack, and I was like, well, maybe I should hit some crack. Maybe that'll make me feel better.
No, that's not how that conversation went. She looked at me. She's like, what would you think if I tried crack? And I looked at her dead serious. I was like, that's the worst decision you are ever going to make. But I've been with her enough years at this point to know, like, there's nothing I can do to stop her. She's made up her mind to do it. And so she did. And from that day until we lost the house, it was like less than 3 months probably.
Yeah.
And so when we lost the house, we went to the only place we needed to go, which was the trap. So we ended up living like either in stolen vehicles or trap houses for the next 6 months. I mean, like it went down so fast.
We had always had money because of the businesses that we ran. So all of the guys in the trap houses just welcomed us with open arms.
Yeah, you know, of course they did.
They loved us there.
Yeah.
So that's the first place we went and ran to. That was like our family until we ran out of money. And then it started getting a little sketchy. And we ended up, I know there's one point we got kidnapped.
With our kid. Dope debt.
With your kids.
Twice that happened.
Yes. They were very nice about it,
though.
It was
a polite kidnapping. It was a polite kidnapping. But, yeah, like, we're just running around South Memphis with our kid with prostitutes and dope boys and murderers. Like, it was normal.
Well, it was normal.
Yeah, it was normal to us.
That was normal. That was a normal everyday thing.
Yeah. And then finally, you know, I started – we went to detox several times during that time period. Mostly me. I was fed up with it. I'd had a normal life, and I wanted it back. You know, this was all she'd ever known. So she was a little harder to find rock bottom. And finally, in May of 2019, I woke up in an empty lot next to the trap house on Wilbur, covered in blood, didn't have a cut on my body. To this day, I don't know what happened. Like, I don't know if I hurt somebody. Maybe I was helping somebody. I have no idea. And I called my dad, and, you know, I'd not asked my parents for much in quite a while because they knew what I was up to. And dad was like, dude, I'm going to get you a Greyhound ticket. I want you to just come home, you know, just come home. And at first he sent me money for a Greyhound ticket, so we all know what I did with that. So that prolonged my exit for a few days. But finally, he just bought a ticket and was like, just show up at the Greyhound station. And so I did. A week later, Jess was like, you know what? I'm done too. Come get me. And that was it. Like, we went to Georgia and started rebuilding our lives from absolutely nothing. Like we finally hit rock bottom. We had nothing but the clothes on our back, but we had, I guess, beaten the habit.
Well, I'll never say beaten.
But yeah, but we'd get the monkey off our back long enough to do something different with it.
But we did have this little prayer we would say in the trap house while we were like smoking crack, as stupid as that sounds, for God to get us out of hell, and we promised that we would come back for those that we left behind. That will come in later in our story, which is, it's very important to us because it's what we're doing now every single day. But for a long time after we got clean, you know, we had to go live in his parents' house. We had absolutely nothing but the clothes on our backs, and we finally got like a townhouse, and we kept moving on up and got our businesses back off the ground. And then in 2021, when Afghanistan collapsed, Ben got a call from somewhere. Here, you say that because you're better with it. It's your story.
So I own a company called Black Rifle. We initially started it as gun e-commerce, and it was called Black Rifle Co. We rebranded it as a data intelligence company selling marketing data to the gun industry. Some guy hit me up, a Marine intel officer hit me up, thinking I was Black Rifle Coffee Company, wanting us to fund safe housing in Afghanistan. And I was like, I'm not the coffee company, but there was a point in time in my life where I really wanted to go to Afghanistan. Tell me more. And we hit it off. So you skipped a whole bunch there. We both have weaponized ADHD. So in 2019, when we moved to my parents' house and got clean, we left my best friend on the streets of Memphis, who we'd been trying to get to come on this recovery journey with us. You know, I'd met him in jail, and we were on drug court together. He graduated. He ended up getting, like, the MVP award for drug court, which is kind of ironic because now he's in my glove box and I'm sitting here talking to you. So he obviously overdosed and died. And I was the one that made the call to go, you know, have somebody check on him. They found him dead and decomposing. I'm sure you're familiar with the concept of reservations when somebody gets into recovery. They maintain that circumstance in their head that when X happens, I'm going to relapse, and everybody has to understand it. Brandon dying was our reservation. And so now it's come to fruition. We've got the green light to go ahead and relapse. Nobody's going to judge us. And instead, we did the exact opposite. We decided to use my social media presence, which was pretty big back then, to raise money to bury him or to cremate him because he had no family left, nothing. We actually called the drug court that had terminated me and tried to send me to prison and told her to leave me and asked if we could raise the money through them. Like, we're going to raise it for y'all. I'm going to make a GoFundMe. And I think that opened their eyes that maybe Ben's not the piece of shit we thought he was. So we did successfully raise the money to bury Brandon. And that did something to us mentally. Like, we loved being able to use our social media platform to raise money, not for us, but for somebody who could never repay it. So that seed had already been planted. So when the Afghan stuff popped off, I was like, this is it. We had just started a nonprofit called Flanders Fields. The purpose was to help other vets battling opiate addiction, you know, get out of that situation. And we looked at the Afghan collapse as an opportunity to put that nonprofit to work. And so we put our junkie skill sets to use. You know how addicts are. Like, we don't want to break the law, but we're comfortable doing it. You know what I mean? So when Afghanistan collapsed, you had all of these special operations vets and three-letter agencies trying to figure out how to get our allies out of Afghanistan. And they're all worried about things I'd never heard of, like the Foreign Agent Registration Act and the Logan Act. And I'm like, I don't give a fuck. Let's just go rent some houses in Afghanistan, put these people in them, fly them to America, and figure out what's next. And so that's basically what we did. Through that process, we gained trust with a whole lot of people in the special operations community, within the federal government, within law enforcement circles. We ended up doing it again in Ukraine. We did it again in Haiti. That's how we got introduced to the whole counter-trafficking movement, because there was a lot of that going on in Afghanistan, both narcotics and child trafficking. And I tell you all that to bring it all back full circle, that promise that we used to make, the foxhole prayer, that if God would get us out of hell, we'd come back for everybody we left behind. that's exactly what we're doing today. We've taken all of those connections we made through Afghanistan and said we're going to refocus all of this on the dope tracks in Memphis. We're going to go back to Memphis, and we're going to not only get our friends out, not only get the people we left behind out, we're going to start tackling narco trafficking. We're going to start tackling the violent crime epidemic in Memphis. And it started really slow, like 2022, I think we approached drug court and asked the judge if he would be open to kind of mentoring us through the process of what that would look like. And he suggested we buy Rebos. Rebos is sober spelled backwards. It's the name of the network of halfway houses that I mentioned earlier that I got kicked out of. And so we ended up raising the money to make a down payment on it. We couldn't buy them outright, but I mortgaged those halfway houses. So now we've got a base of operations in Memphis, and we decided we were going to start going back to the actual dope tracks and see if we can figure out how to shut those houses down. And that started a weird – our life is surreal today. To think that we're like actually I own the house where I hit rock bottom. I own the house where my friends died. And we're using these houses to take trafficking survivors and other addicts on their own recovery journey to kind of bring them back. Now, we're doing it by enlisting the help of not only the streets but the law enforcement agencies that used to arrest us all the time, the same courts that prosecuted me I don't even know how many times. We just started going block by block, you know, trying to negotiate with the street gangs, with Gangster Disciples, Vice Lords, Memphis Mob. Like, we want to shut this house down. I want you guys to go do something somewhere else. And that – you can imagine that conversation is a strange one to have. Like, you don't just walk in and say, hey, bro, I want to shut your trap house down, and I want you to help me do it, you know? It's a process. We were able to kind of cheat in Memphis because we already know a lot of these guys because we spent six figures on dope with them, so they know we're not the police, you know. And at the same time, we're doing street outreach to the prostitutes and the other addicts out there, and you slowly start getting enough of them into treatment. You remove that financial incentive for that house to operate on that block. And what we figured out is, like, if you get the troublesome crack whore into rehab, nobody's mad at you for that. They wanted her off the streets anyway because she's an existential threat to them. If she gets arrested, the likelihood of her flipping is pretty high. Yeah. And so, like, that's kind of how that process started. We were able to negotiate a price on the first trap house on Wilbert Street, like, mid-2022. The last violent crime that happened on that street was the day I bought the house. We had a dude get shot three times coming out of it. We then replicated that process on another dope track that we used to frequent a lot, Melrose Street. We've now got four properties on that one. ADHD
123. I know.
And then we started getting, you know, calls from law enforcement who were watching what we're doing because of the local news coverage we've gotten. I mean, asking us like, hey, you know, if we've got this girl that we think probably just needs help rather than getting arrested for the 43rd time, what could we do? And so now we're getting referrals from law enforcement. We've been able to lean on law enforcement when we've got a dope boy that gets rolled up. And we know for a fact that dude will be much more impactful to the youth of Memphis than I could ever be. Is there any way we can work something out where this guy doesn't go to prison forever, you know? And it's interesting, law enforcement, if they've been in it long enough, they realize you're never going to arrest your way out of addiction. You know, if we could arrest our way out of the war on drugs, it would have been over 45 years ago. It's a revolving door. Fortunately, we're lucky in Memphis. Like, nobody seems to buy into the mentality that they appear to have in San Francisco and Skid Row, where it's just like this laissez-faire attitude, we're not going to mess with it, under the guise of compassion and harm reduction. You go take a look at Skid Row. That's the end state of harm reduction. It's like slow motion eugenics, man. The safe using spots. Like, I can see the value of needle exchange. You know, we've volunteered at one, and I was at first flatly opposed to it. But anyway, fortunately, law enforcement in Memphis doesn't take that attitude. Jail sucks a lot. Jail is a motivator. It helped me get clean. I got tired of being in and out of jail. And eventually, this, like all the stuff that we're doing there, the number of gang diversion and interdiction that we've been able to do, the number of dope boys we've been able to pull out of the game, the number of addicts and sex trafficking survivors we've been able to pull out started getting attention in D.C. We ended up getting invited to the White House to sit with the Deputy Chief of Staff up there last year to talk about Memphis specifically and the violent crime epidemic that we're having. If you've been following the news, you know we got the Memphis Safe Task Force now. We leapfrogged ahead of Chicago on that. We've got the ICE deployment in Memphis, but you notice it's not having – we're not having all the riots and everything that you're seeing out here or in Minneapolis. And the reason for that is pretty simple. We're all collaborating and working together. We've been able to get violent crime down about 70%. There's not this huge mass arrest of, you know, Pablo the roofer, like we're actually going after the child predators. We're actually going after the big bad narco traffickers. And it's this weird public-private partnership where you got a bunch of crackheads partnering up with a bunch of former special operators, partnering up with a bunch of three-letter agencies. And the whole mission is to end suffering in the Mid-South. Thanks for attending my TED Talk. But, I mean, we've been able to move the needle in some really cool ways.
And this has been going on for how many years?
So we started in earnest in 2021, right about this time, so 5 years. And the mission to take back the dope track probably started February of 22. Mm-hmm. And in that time, we've been able to completely shut down four fentanyl trafficking operations without sending anybody to – five now – without sending anybody to jail, without shooting anybody. It's just a collaborative effort working with the streets, with the dope boys and the addicts. We've lost count of how many trafficking recoveries we've done, but several dozen. We've worked ops with a dozen agencies in the Mid-South. We've recovered kids from sex trafficking. Like all of the negative, nasty shit that you see as a result of dope. And in Memphis in particular, I would say 95% of the violent crime and sex crimes go back to addiction in one shape, form, or fashion. We've been able to impact those in some pretty significant ways without arresting people, without any authority, without a gun or a badge. Well, that's a lie. I always have a gun, but I don't use it. It's just there if I need it. You know?
What would you say is the secret to your success?
Human connection. There's no doubt about it. It is human connection. It comes down to being able to sit down across, just like we're doing right here, from somebody who has a completely different background than you, or maybe the same background, and finding that common ground. Accepting and realizing that we are all going through this struggle called life together, and there's no reason for us to be at each other's throats all the time.
Well, I think a lot of it is that we've been there. Like, we've been homeless. We've been dope fiends. So, like, when we're sitting there with the prostitutes or when they're, you know, the people that other – that society just looks down upon – we're cool just sitting up with you and sharing a pizza. I'll go get you a pizza. I'll go get you some Newports. Let's talk. And I think that's a thing that a lot of them don't have. They don't have people that see them as human and can just sit there and talk with them. And we gain trust. That's a big thing. Is trust is currency.
Trust is 100% currency out there.
So with a lot of people, we do have that because, well, they've a lot of them have seen us on the streets. They've seen us beat the shit out of each other in a $700 truck with stolen plates.
Mostly her beating the shit out of me.
But
we've got that credibility. But I don't want to make it sound like what we're doing only works because we have that, because we've been able to replicate this in other cities. The reason we were in Tenderloin was to find a missing girl. And within 12 hours, we were able to get the streets to help us locate her. Like, people I've never met in my life are helping us find an addict. And that's a hard population to get to back you, to get to convince that you're not the police, you're not looking for this girl because she's got a warrant out of state or something. We were able to find her, get her parents, sit down with her. We don't have a happy ending yet, but you know how that goes. Like, it's going to take a dozen or more contacts usually. But it comes down to human connection. And Jess hit the nail on the head. Trust is how you start that process of human connection. And I'm firmly convinced that what we're doing in Memphis would work literally anywhere. It's obviously more challenging in a place like this because you've got a legislature and a population that just seems to greenlight the harm reduction mentality, which there's there's a balance we got to find in that. You know, the law and order, hang them high, is not going to work. And then the coddle them and enable them until they're dead isn't going to work either. Like, you've got to get in that middle somewhere. And that's going to take people with lived experience getting out there and hitting the streets. It's going to take stories getting out there, which is why I absolutely love what you're doing. You know, you're getting these stories out there, and you're humanizing a population that I think most of America does not see as human.
Yeah, knowledge is power.
100%.
And this information helps us understand and maybe work with some facts that might help prevent these things in the future.
Yeah.
And what do you guys see for the future?
So we've just gotten a 30,000 square foot building donated to us that we're going to turn into a treatment center. You know, we have to lean on community partners, and we do have great community partners in Memphis. But if I go do a trafficking recovery today and I have a female that's ready to accept services right there on the spot, there's no waiting. You can't say, well, we'll get you connected tomorrow. You're going to lose her. You've got a 30-second window to say, I got you a bed right now. So we have to go to the first available bed, which is usually in a place that only does medical detox, all right? Now you've got to connect the dots for that female to get from detox to a 28-day rehab. And from there, you've got to keep up with her to make sure she gets into job skills training, you know, help with a resume, back into school, connected with food stamps, Medicaid, parenting classes, financial literacy. Like, the list goes on and on. It's not just, I saved you from trafficking, go live a happy life. Right? That's make-believe. It's doing counter-trafficking work is not like you see on TV where you kick in a door and you go in the room and like, I'm saved. No. It is a very long process. So we're trying to bring all of those services under one roof to where we don't lose people in those gaps, to where we can get them everything they need to go literally from the gutter back to being a productive member of society and hopefully in their kids' lives again. So where I see the future, we're going to have this – I got to come up with $3.5 million. It's only money. I'll figure it out. You know, we're going to have that fired up, and it's going to be a game changer for us. We've been able to get over 500 people navigated on that journey I just described without having our own building. So I feel like when we do finally get the doors, I'm going to refer to it as 777 because that's the address, 777 South Main Street. When we have 777 finally opened up, it is going to be a game changer for us. And we're trying to document and blueprint as much of this as we can so that people all over the country can go replicate it. It's a challenge, obviously, to raise money. My value prop is like, hey, I'm a crackhead with lived experience. I'm trying to go do good shit. You want to give me some money? No. No, that didn't usually happen. We still have to, you know, run our own businesses. So, like, I still have my day job I have to focus on. We've also got a lot of kids, including one that we brought over from Afghanistan that we're putting through medical school now. So trying to find the balance on all that's insane. 777 is going to be the solution to that because I can finally have paid staff that is generating revenue. You know, rehabs throw off money. And if I can have paid staff, I think we can do a hell of a lot more than we've already done. But I think the very important piece of that to me is to be able to blueprint this so that other cities can take advantage of it. Every city has people with lived experience. Every city has people, maybe not that care as much as you do, but they've got somebody that wants to elevate these stories. You know, and that's – it's going to take all of those disparate pieces coming together to be able to do what we've done. Violent crime in Memphis – Look, a year ago, we were America's deadliest city. And I've been saying for 4 years, we're going to change that. I think we're already out of the top five. We've had a 70% reduction in violent crime in like 4 months, 5 months. Staggering. And that is something that's being seen across the nation. Violent crime is coming down quickly, and it's not just because of the law enforcement surges that are happening everywhere. It's definitely not because of the National Guard getting deployed. They don't have anything to do with that. America as a whole, I feel like, is ready for this to happen. We're sick of seeing our neighbors suffer. And I think that if you actually get out on a street level and talk with people, the division that we're seeing all over the media, it's manufactured. It's not real. Never once in all the work have we done have I had somebody be like, you know, before I accept services to you guys, I need to know how you vote. That's never happened. I've never had somebody tell me they can't accept our help because we're white and they're black. All of these little things that the media keeps harping on to keep us divided and separate, political ideology collapses at first contact with human suffering every time. And maybe my view is skewed on that because all I do is deal with human suffering. But I firmly believe, I really, really do in my heart of hearts, that America is ready for this big unity, you know, kumbaya moment where we can all come together and save each other.
Maybe. That's a wonderful thing you guys are doing.
Well, thank you.
What is the name of your nonprofit?
So the name of the nonprofit is We Fight Monsters. Our website's wefightmonsters.org, or you can find us on YouTube, youtube.com/monsterfighters.
All right. Jessica and Ben, thank you so much for sharing your story. And I wish you guys all the luck in the world.
Appreciate it, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing the platform with us.
Great job. Thank you.